From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the very best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Tess Vigeland. This episode, we've all heard the worries.
There is going to be a substantive portion of the Gen X group that will not have a secure retirement.
But when did Americans decide workers were entitled to retire in the first place? And speaking of retirement, David Finkel leaves the Emerson String Quartet after 33 years with the Classical Chamber Ensemble.
In some ways, it was business as usual, but when I had a moment to think that, it was my last Emerson session, it was quite a sensation.
They have a new album out, and it is the last recording before Finkel hands the cello chair to a new member. Also, a new thriller novel that promises to be a summer bestseller.
It's about a time-traveling serial killer, so he's unstoppable and untraceable.
And how do you create a convincing coral reef out of fiberglass, concrete, and polyester? Well, we'll go to the National Aquarium in Baltimore, Maryland to find out from the experts. All of that and more on this week's podcast. So listen up and enjoy. For almost a century, it's been a tenet of the American dream. Work hard enough, and you'll get to rest and relax in your golden years. Travel, volunteer, see the grandchildren. It's a familiar image in TV ads for companies that manage retirement funds.
Your generation is definitely not headed for bingo night. In fact, you could write a book about how you're going to turn retirement upside down.
But retirement as we know it may be consigned to the dustbin of history. According to a new Pew study, Generation X, aged 38 to 47, is on track to be the first generation to do worse in retirement than its parents, assuming it retires at all. That's our cover story today, Rethinking Retirement, Gen X and Beyond.
I'm Michael Powers, 47 years old. I live in Washoe Valley, Nevada. I'm a carpenter slash cabinet maker slash woodworker, and I think I'll be retiring the day I die.
I'm Catherine Powers. I'm 46. I manage an office suites company, and I guess I'll be retired right after I die.
Michael and Catherine Powers are hardly alone. There is no other way to put this. Middle-aged Americans are in dire straits, with a median net worth of just $15,000. What was once a guaranteed notion of retirement at 65 is as antiquated as your grandmother's silver. The Powers have three children, and like many people of their generation, they didn't even start saving for retirement until well into their 30s.
We did start saving probably only about 15 years ago. I had a profit sharing with the construction company that I used to work for, but that's all gone now.
In 2007, business was booming. The housing bubble kept Michael busy, and the couple was able to save. They'd put away more than $15,000 when the crash came.
When the economy started failing, you know, we lost a whole bunch of the money that we had in, and, you know, we even at one point had to take some out.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was getting really bad there for a while.
2009 was the worst year. After Michael lost his job, they used the small retirement fund for daily living expenses. He says things are better now, but it's still tough to make ends meet.
I was making between $100,000 and $110,000 a year. And then now, last year, we made $30,000. You know, we're not poor. We're very thrifty. You know, we don't buy new things.
Which we would do anyway.
Yeah, which we would do mostly anyway. But there's no retirement. There's, you know, not a lot of extras happening.
Of that 15 grand they'd saved before the recession, only a tiny bit remains.
We have an IRA that has about $500 in it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. That's probably generous. $317 in Facebook stock, to be honest.
Gen X looks to be the first generation that will not exceed the wealth of the group that came before them and to potentially face downward mobility in retirement.
That's Aaron Currier with the Pew Charitable Trusts. Last month, they released a big study comparing the retirement savings of Generation X to previous generations, from baby boomers who are 48 to 65 years old to Gen Xers.
What we did was look at replacement rates, which is how much savings and wealth a person will have to be able to replace their pre-retirement income. Most financial planners recommend being able to replace 70 to 100%. And the typical early boomer has acquired enough savings and wealth to replace between 70 and 80% of their income once they leave the labor market.
So they're right on target.
They're right on target. The typical late boomer will replace about 60%, which is a little bit insecure.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical Gen Xer is only on track to replace 50%.
Well, let's zero in on the Gen Xers. We are, what, 5 going on 6 years past the financial crisis of 2008-2009. How much did that hurt this particular generation?
Well, the Great Recession absolutely took the largest toll on Gen X. They lost the highest percentage of net worth than the other groups, losing an average of $33,000 in their net worth. And they also took the biggest hit to their home equity in terms of percentage loss. So as a group, they definitely got hit. But even before the recession, there were signs that they were not on track to sort of exceed the wealth and the savings of the group that came immediately before them.
Aside from the Great Recession, let's talk about the retirement system itself and where that might be playing into this lack of retirement funding for Gen X. How much of a role does the 401k system play in all this?
That's a great question. What we know from the data is that less than half of Americans have access to a 401k through their employer, and a very small percentage of them try to get retirement plans on their own through an IRA. So for the group that is in the stock market, they've been able to, certainly they took a hit during the recession, but they've also been able to take advantage of some of the recovery that has occurred since. For people who are not engaged in any kind of retirement planning whatsoever, unless some dramatic change happens in terms of their savings rates and their ability to acquire wealth, there is going to be a substantive portion of the Gen X group that will not have a secure retirement.
And that does not bode well for Gen Y and the millennials.
No, it does not.
Erin Currier of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Why is this generation having such a tough time? Well, they took out big loans for college, and wages have not kept up with the cost of living. But they also, for the most part, are doing without a retirement savings vehicle that previous generations had. Michael Powers, for one, misses it.
It's not like, you know, our grandparents had it with, you know, jobs with pensions. And, I mean, for a normal working person, you know, there are no jobs with pensions or insurance.
For most Americans under 50, the savings vehicle they're most likely to use is the 401k. Instead of a company automatically setting aside and managing a pension for you, the 401k allows workers, but does not require them, to invest their own money. Sometimes there's a company match. In theory, it gives you freedom.
Our experiment with the do-it-yourself, individual-directed, commercially provided 401k plan has not worked. It's a abysmal failure in almost every way, and almost all experts agree that something has to change.
Teresa Giller-Ducci studies retirement policy at the New School.
When people were retiring 15 years ago, many of those people who had pensions, and those were middle-class people and up, had defined benefit plans, which gave them a pension for life on top of their Social Security. 5 years later, into the mid-90s, 2000s, and now you're finding people who have a lump of money and their Social Security. And that lump, on average, is about $70,000 for people now just retiring. And they're told that they are supposed to handle that $70,000 for the rest of their lives. And they're also told that they may live until they're 92.
Teresa, if the pension system didn't work because there were promises made that couldn't be kept, companies that essentially did not do what they promised their workers they would do, and now the 401k system is not working because it counts too much on us to be wise and prudent with our money, what kind of system should we have?
What works is to go back to the basics. Make sure that people save where they can save, and that's at the workplace. And you start at the very beginning of your work life, and you contribute a little bit. If you start like 5%, if you start saving at 45, you have to save 10 or more percent of your income. If you start at 50, it's not too late, but you have to ratchet down your spending and really ratchet up your savings to almost 25%.
But Teresa, don't we know at this point that people aren't built to save on their own?
Yes, Tess, you're right. People, human beings, cannot be told to withhold their consumption when everyone else around them is consuming, and the place where they would save their money isn't safe. So there has to be new institutions that guarantee a modest but safe continual rate of return. And we can do that by adding to the Social Security system a place where people can save their money and get a rate of return that's safe, maybe 3%. Or states, Tess, are looking into ways that their residents can save money through the public employees' retirement systems in the states. Oregon, Connecticut, Maryland, New York, Washington are all states that are looking into statewide options to the 401k system.
Teresa Ghilarducci, director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School. For all the efforts in enhancing the retirement system on the state level, most reforms will come too late for people now in their late 30s and 40s, meaning people like Catherine Powers may have to revise their vision for retirement.
We've been married for 26 years. It would be nice just go on road trips together and spend time alone together since we've had a child in the house for over 22 years now.
And missing out on that part of life isn't just bad for the Powers. Analyst Teresa Ghilarducci says it's bad for all of us.
This idea of whether or not we are entitled to retirement is a great question. After the Great Depression, there was this idea that everybody deserves some time to themselves to decide what they do with their time. They got the weekend, they got holidays, and they got retirement. And to me, that's one of the most precious periods of our life, because we're going to die after that period, and we need some time to connect to not only the people that we love, but what psychologists call, we need a time to create a personal narrative about what our life meant.
A concept of our golden years that increasingly feels like a mirage. The Emerson String Quartet is one of the most acclaimed chamber music groups in the world. Since its founding in 1976, the quartet has won 9 Grammys for its recordings. They have a new CD out called Journeys, and it's the last recording with cellist David Finkel, who's retiring from the quartet after 33 years. David Finkel joins us now from New York City. So nice to have you on the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this new album, Journeys. It starts out with Tchaikovsky's Souvenir de Florence, which is the first 4 tracks on the new CD. Let's play a little bit of that first movement.
I will say, listening to the Tchaikovsky, it doesn't really sound very much like Florence, does it? At least not the Florence I know. Maybe the Florence when the Arno flooded. But you know, it's an amazing work, because there are moments of Florentine sunshine and leisurely afternoons in it, but it's basically a very Russian piece, and it's extraordinary and exciting, and I'm so glad I had the chance to record this with my quartet.
Well, we hear the end results of what I imagine must be long hours of very hard practice. So what goes into a recording like this one, and how much of that practice is solitary and how much is with the group?
You know, private practice is like, you know, it's almost like your underwear. You know, you don't wear it out in public, but you know, you make sure it's in good order before you put your clothes on, what everybody sees. The working together in rehearsals in an ensemble is something that you have to plan and schedule, and people take a best guess at how many hours it's going to take to bring it to readiness for stage or recording studio. And sometimes you overschedule and sometimes you underschedule. And if you've underscheduled somewhere in the sessions, you make up the difference.
David Finkel, what was the experience of recording this last album with the quartet? Was it business as usual, bittersweet for you?
You know, you have to sort of put on your blinders sometimes and remember that the most important thing you're doing is playing the cello, playing in the ensemble, interpreting the work. I went through this not only with the recording, but with all the many last time appearances that I made with the quartet. I was well aware that, you know, it would be the last time I would play in Florence or the last time I would play in Munich. But, you know, you can't let those thoughts overtake you when you have the business of making music in front of you. So, yes, in some ways it was business as usual, but when I had a moment to think that, it was my last Emerson session, it was quite a sensation.
Do you think that that seeped into these performances?
I don't think so.
No.
I certainly would not have intended anything to be different in these performances other than what we had intended for the music.
Well, the other piece on this album is by Schoenberg, who is, of course, famously atonal, very difficult to play. Let's hear a little bit of that. So we compare that with what we just heard with the Tchaikovsky. How did you come up with this pairing? Tchaikovsky's so romantic and melodical, really very different here.
The passage that you happen to select to play is not necessarily atonal, but it moves through many different keys very, very quickly. The result of atonality or modulating a lot is that you don't feel firmly grounded. You know, your world is floating. But, you know, for all of us, sometimes our worlds float. We're in transition, we're in turmoil, and this music expresses all of those things beautifully and very powerfully. The Schoenberg is not aromantic. It is actually one of the most romantic pieces in the literature. You know, there's a story that goes with it. It was inspired by a poem about two lovers walking in the moonlight, and during this walk, the woman confesses to the man that she is pregnant by another man, and after a lot of turmoil, the current boyfriend says, you know, I will accept the child as my own. It's an incredibly romantic and turbulent story, and it's all reflected in the music.
Do you have a favorite moment from the CD?
Oh, well, you know, I have to speak selfishly about the cello solos. That both Tchaikovsky and Schoenberg reserve some of their most glorious melodies for the cello. In the Schoenberg, for example, at the moment where the man announces his forgiveness of his girlfriend, there is an incredibly beautiful, positive cello solo. Glowing, magnificent, and, you know, I always feel like just the greatest guy in the world when I'm playing that, unless I'm playing it badly. But I try not to do that, ever.
You know, I think some people may not realize this, but in the world of classical music, it's quite common to swap out players, but certainly not with the Emerson Quartet. You've been the same since 1979, so I'm wondering how you broke the news to your fellow performers, your friends, that you decided to leave. Did they have an inkling that it might happen?
I think the other guys were shocked but not surprised. I mean, the world knows as well as they do how many hats I wear. And yes, of course, they were the first to know, and we had quite a few long, heartfelt discussions about the future of the quartet and what shape it should take and what the options were. You know, just a couple of nights ago in Montreal, they played their first concert with cellist Paul Watkins, and I sent them a bottle of champagne backstage, and in my home at 8 o'clock that evening, I opened a bottle of champagne, and so it was a really nice moment. It was the culmination of like a 2-year project for me to successfully disengage from the quartet and see it continue in high style.
Well, you know, as you look back, any highlights that jump to mind of your time with the Emerson?
You know, there are so many highlights, and you know, a lot of them are just personal. You know, I remember when every single one of the Emerson children was born, when somebody got a call in the middle of the night or had to run away from some rehearsal or concert to be with their wives. We've walked out on stage together when we were all absolutely scared to death and had no idea what was going to happen and somehow got through it. We've lived through various disasters in concerts together and forgiven each other for them. I mean, these are all highlights of a classical music career, and we could not be more fortunate to have them.
The Emerson Quartet was not your only job over the last years. You're also a teacher. You created the music at Menlo Festival. You tour with your wife, the pianist Wu Han. Are you planning to keep doing those once you leave the quartet, or are you planning for a quiet retirement?
Even after leaving the Emerson Quartet, I still am holding down 8 jobs.
Whoa. So where are you going to fit in your golf game?
I'm sorry to confess, I really have no interest. Maybe someday.
I would say you're busy enough. Well, David Finkel, thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing all of these other things that you will continue to do as you lead the Emerson String Quartet.
Well, thank you so much. I think anybody that stays in touch with classical music probably will not be able to avoid seeing me somewhere or other.
They will be happy to hear that. Today is World Oceans Day, a perfect excuse for a visit to the National Aquarium in Baltimore, Maryland, where they're prepping for the grand opening of a new $13 million wing. In early July, the Black Tip Reef exhibit will bare its teeth to visitors, really big teeth belonging to sharks from the Indo-Pacific. In preparation for their arrival and other fish and sea turtles, artisans have been hard at work recreating that reef with fake coral.
Here's a staghorn mold that we set up in port earlier. We can demold it, take the clamps off.
Paul Valiquette heads the coral design team. He walks us through a warehouse where they've been hard at work sculpting, molding, and painting fake coral that will bring the Black Tip Reef exhibit to life.
And it just peels apart.
Boy, okay. that is taking you some effort to get that out of there.
Yeah, this is a tough one. And then you just clean up this flashing.
It's something most aquarium visitors take for granted, the detailed coral reef structures that form a kaleidoscopic backdrop for the main attraction, sharks, rays, sea turtles. But most of that coral is not coral, which makes sense if you think about it. Coral takes hundreds of years to grow into a reef, and curators can't exactly carve chunks out of natural reefs without destroying the ecosystem. So Valiquette and his team make it.
The coral rock is made by creating a form, and it's basically a big fiberglass shell. And on that goes texture. There's some gravel and sand, and then it gets base painted with epoxy paint. All these different sponges and things are also polyester. They're sculpted on the piece.
It's a deeply intricate process, but inspiration is just down the hall in giant tanks that look like they must have come from the set of a science fiction movie.
Oh my goodness, sharks!
Those are the guys. These are Black Tip Reef sharks headed to the exhibit.
They're swimming around in what looks like a large above-ground pool. At the center of the shark pool, Valiquette points to a sample of his reef.
What I'm testing for is usually either buoyancy, will it float or will it sink, or a color, set up an exhibit light and see the effect of the water depth on the color.
The test coral also gives the reef sharks and the other marine animals a sense of the life that awaits them in the exhibit.
When they go in the tank, we don't know how they're going to react to the reef. My concern is some of them, especially the turtle, I've seen turtles go in and just rip them all up. So hopefully she won't do that.
Less than a mile from the warehouse, we get a sneak peek at the aquarium's still-under-construction reef exhibit. Jack Cover is the general curator. He looks down over the tank as saltwater slowly inches up over the fake reef.
Yeah, what we're looking at here is a patch reef, and so we have different types of species of coral. and some are purple, some are bright yellow. You can see the brain corals down there, which look like a brain. Some of them more like the antlers on a deer, sponges, bright orange coral fan structures you're going to see deeper. They're all situated in the sort of the levels that they would be found on a real reef. It's kind of like the New York City of the ocean. It's a big structure. There's day sleepers, there's night sleepers. So there's activity going on all the time.
So you have, the Tenderloin and Soho and Midtown, maybe?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of little neighborhoods within this. Actually, you aren't too far off of that because we recreate the structure of these natural ecosystems.
Given that this is not real coral, how do you convince the marine life in there that this is real when it's not?
Well, it's really the shapes. They're really responding more to and the physical structure of it.
So this is a coral cave. It's what you would find deep or, you know, undercover.
Paul Valiquette takes us downstairs to what will be the underwater viewing area. We look through three large windows at the recreated coral reef, pops of purple, red, orange, muted for now, in about 4 feet of murky blue water covering half the fabricated reef.
So you have some things that are in the cave, and here's one of the staghorn thickets that would be a great place for chromis and other small damselfish would hang out. And then as you come around here to the big window, you see the coral rising and rising and rising up to the reef crest further back. The last window to the right here, these dense flats of small branching corals. There's a continuous network of caves at the base of that abut right up to the window, so you can see down inside, and there'll be a lot of smaller animals hiding from the bigger predators up against the window. Well, that's our hope.
A unique view of an Indo-Pacific reef and the corals that create them. Well, sort of. Over the last 15 years, South African writer Lauren Bucus has kept herself pretty busy. She's a journalist, a screenwriter, a documentarian, and lately a novelist. Her high-concept thrillers dazzled readers over the last 5 years. This week, she released her third novel. It's called The Shining Girls. And like most action-packed page-turners, the plot gets a little complicated, so I'll let her take over.
It's about a time-traveling serial killer. So he's unstoppable and untraceable. And he's hunting over 60 years in Chicago and picking out women who shine in some way. They have some kind of inner spark until one of his victims survives and she turns the hunt around.
So the book opens and we meet the two main characters. A 6-year-old girl is playing in the dirt. A strange older man approaches her and she's feeling like maybe there's a little danger here. So to calm her down, he gives her a toy, an orange plastic pony. Let's have you read from there.
In desperation, he takes out the orange pony. Here, he jabs it at her, willing her to take it. One of the objects that connects everything together. What is it? She says. A pony! Damn it, just take it, okay? It's a present. I don't want it, she sniffs. Okay, it's not a present, it's a deposit. You're keeping it safe for me, like at the bank, when you give them your money. The sun is beating down. It is too hot to be wearing a coat. He is feeling calmer already. Everything is as it has to be. Now keep this safe, all right? It's real important. I'll come to get it, you understand? Why? Because I need it. I'll see you when you're all grown up. Look out for me, okay, sweetheart? I'll come back for you.
Lauren Bucus reading from her new book, The Shining Girls. Lauren, so these are our two main characters, Kirby and Harper, and we follow them through the novel. Where do they go from here?
It kind of becomes a death duel between them because Harper comes back in 1989 to try and kill Kirby. What he doesn't know is that she survives the attack and she turns the hunt around. She becomes absolutely obsessed with finding the man who did this to her, and she's not going to stop until she does. And it goes all over the place. The whole novel jumps around between times and perspectives. It goes to 1943, where there's an African-American welder. She's a single mom and a widow trying to make a new start of it after her husband died during World War II, to a burlesque dancer in 1931 who dances in radium paint, which, of course, is radioactive and causes radiation burns. through to a young architect in the 50s who is accused of having commie sympathies, and Kirby, the fiery, determined survivor who has become absolutely obsessed by this case, and she's going to find out who the man was who attacked her and try and stop him.
And justifiably so, I may add, given what happened to her. You have some gruesome details throughout this book.
I do, and I know some people have found the violence shocking, but you know what? Violence should be shocking. I really tried to write it in a way that would remind you what it means when we see a dead woman reported on the news, that it's not just a pretty corpse, that it's a person, and that violence is a horrific, terrifying, traumatic, horrible thing for anyone to go through. So I tried to hang it on very specific details so that it wouldn't become like 10 pages of torture porn, but that you would feel the emotional impact of it and the horror. And it's also specifically written from the woman's perspectives, usually, so that you're not complicit with the killer. You're not riding along with him. I really wanted you to be with the woman at the end and to feel what they're going through. And I think maybe that makes it harder to read.
It does. It's exceedingly disturbing, but you can't put it down. How did you decide which historical elements to pick out? I mean, you were very specific with dates that you decided to send these characters through, and then what was happening at those points in time.
Absolutely. Well, I researched a lot into Chicago. I lived in Chicago in 2000 and 2001, and then I went back on a research trip. But, you know, I read a lot. I dug into the history, and there were particular eras that I was specifically interested in. Like, I was very interested in the Red Scare and McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. I think, especially being a South African, with the way that tied into apartheid and the kind of repression and the regime that we went through as well.
It must have been a real challenge for you to come up with so many details for a city that you didn't grow up in.
It was very difficult. I actually worked with two young researchers, and they would find all the little nitty-gritty information. What was a 1931 hospital like? What did the doctors wear? How much would they charge? Mm-hmm. How would they fix a ripped tendon? But then they would also come back with really interesting information. My researcher who was doing that information, that part of it, he came back and said, look, I found all that, but here is also an article about this young woman who danced in radium paint, who was in hospital recovering from radiation burns. And I was like, oh, that's so great, I have to use that.
The Glow Girls. The TV rights have already been purchased by Leonardo DiCaprio's company. What's that like for you, and how about a movie?
Well, there were four bids on the rights, and some of them were movie options. You know, it is a self-contained story, so a movie feels like a really good idea, but the way Appian Way and MRC, who did House of Cards for Netflix, which I found really exciting, that's an exciting model.
Right.
But the way they pitched it to me was, think of it as a 13-hour movie. I was like, yeah, okay. You know, and that would really allow you to get deep into the stories. I think in a two-hour movie, you might kind of skip over The Shining Girls, and it's critically important to me, you know, in the book that the stories are much more about them and their lives and what a loss it is that they've been cut out of society. And I don't know how much of that you'd be able to actually get into 2 hours.
That's the writer Lauren Bukas. Her new book is called The Shining Girls, and it is out now. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Hello, this is Nick Offerman. I'm an actor. I play Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation on NBC. I'm also a woodworker and husband, not necessarily in that order. And the movie I've seen a million times is The Quiet Man, directed by John Ford and starring John Wayne and the beautiful Maureen O'Hara.
A fine, soft day in the spring it was when the train pulled into Castletown, 3 hours late as usual.
Gosh, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. I grew up way out in the country in Illinois, and it was very exciting in the early 80s when we got a VCR. We were not a wealthy family. We never did get cable, but we did own 5 video cassettes, and The Quiet Man was one of them. It was my dad's favorite, and it quickly became mine. It's very nostalgic for me.
I'll tell you why, Micheline O'Flynn, young, small Michael Flynn, who used to wipe my runny nose when I was a kid. Because I'm Sean Thornton, and I was born in that little cottage over there.
A storied, celebrated American boxer kills a man in the ring, and it's so traumatizing for him that he moves to a small town in Ireland. He does his best to keep his fists in his pockets while making a life for himself in this little village, but unfortunately, Maureen O'Hara lives in this village, and she catches both his eye and his heart.
What did you say her name was?
Mary Kate Danaher. And don't be getting any notions into your head.
Mary Kate?
Forget it, Sean, forget it.
He finds himself drawn irretrievably down a stream of emotion, along the banks of which stand her enormous pugilistic brother, who's kind of the antagonistic Bluto-type landlord of the town. And so inexorably they're drawn towards one more battle of the fisticuffs.
He took liberties that he shouldn't have.
I said good morning to her.
Good morning? Yes, but it was good night you had on your mind.
That's a lie.
Put up your fists!
I'm not going to fight you, Dan.
Well, I'm going to fight you!
It's a rather tempestuous love story, you know. There are fists flying as equally as kisses being planted.
So bold one you are. And who gave you leave to be kissing me?
So you can talk.
Yes, I can. I will and I do. And it's more than talk you'll be getting if you step a step closer to me.
Don't worry. You got a wallop.
You'll get over it, I'm thinking.
Well, some things a man doesn't get over so easy.
The favorite scene has got to be when John Wayne is finally provoked to fight the brother, you know, really for the honor of Maureen O'Hara's hand. They end up in this epic fist fight that travels out through the window of the bar, across the town. It's quite gratifying.
He was born and bred in Ireland.
I was a very big fan of John Wayne as a kid, and my dad and I would watch a lot of movies on Sundays on WGN on television. And even though I ended up having a little more of a sense of humor than the Duke, I like to think that I sort of maintain a rugged edifice in the service of authoritarian types.
Comedian George Carlin liked to say that art doesn't have a finish line. Our next guests are the embodiment of that idea. Each is a superstar in his chosen field. Rock music legend, best-selling novelist, record producer. Art they could have been content to pursue to the grave. Instead, they went and wrote a musical together, 13 years in the making. Ghost Brothers of Darkland County was co-written and arranged by John Mellencamp, Stephen King, and T-Bone Burnett. It debuted a little over a year ago on a stage in Atlanta. This week, the trio released a special CD-DVD edition of the production, complete with libretto and a mini-documentary. And the cast here includes Elvis Costello, Sheryl Crow, Kris Kristofferson, and a host of other showbiz legends. The plot is based on something that happened in John Mellencamp's hometown. In fact, as he told me, right there on his land in Indiana, in a cabin he bought. The story dates from the late 1930s.
Two brothers were there late one night with a girl. They got into an argument. They had been drinking. One of the brothers hit the other brother in the head with a poker. You know, he didn't mean to kill him, but he did. And as the girl and the younger brother were driving into town, they lost control of the car on the gravel road. Went into the lake, they drowned, so all three kids were killed that evening. And when they went back to get the boy who had been hit with the poker in the front yard, some animal had chewed his head off.
Mellencamp recounted the chilling details to a friend of his, a talent agent.
This was about the time that Mamma Mia and all that stuff was happening on Broadway. And I was getting all these requests to do that with a bunch of my songs, and I wasn't particularly interested in it. And I told this guy this story, and he said, oh, that would make a great Broadway show. And I said, yeah, if you could get Stephen King to write it. He said, well, I'm Stephen King's agent.
Enter the King of Horror.
Hi, yeah, Steve King.
The two had never met before, and at first, King was a tough sell.
I've taken calls from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who wanted me to write the scariest devil worship movie ever made. And, you know, there was a call from David Bowie who wanted about the same thing. So what I'm trying to say is a lot of times very talented artists have very bad ideas.
But King invited Mellencamp to visit his home in Florida, where the rocker again shared the story of the three dead kids and the idea he had to bring it to the stage.
And I sat down with my wife, who is the smartest guy in the room at any time, and I said, what do you think? Because usually when I say that, she says, I don't think you should have anything to do with this. You got too much to do, blah, blah, blah. She said, he's like you, he thinks like you, he talks like you, I think you should do it.
Still, Mellencamp was realistic about the odds of a project like this getting off the ground. Both were busy with other things, and at the time, Stephen King was recouping from an accident that almost killed him. He'd been walking on the side of a road when a distracted driver struck him from behind.
He was on a cane, and I really kind of felt sorry for him. And
you still feel sorry for me, don't you, John?
Not as much as I did. Not as much as I did. I said, I don't mind waiting, Steve. You know, I'm in no big hurry for this. So, you know, when you get around to it, you get around to it. And literally within 10 days, I get like 65 pages of the synopsis where he had taken that little ghost story and made it into a Stephen King story.
You know what a loser is? Someone who can do in a game what he can't do in real life.
Tell him you can prove it.
And I'll prove it. You see that bowl of fruit?
Stop! This is crazy!
I will just put this apple on my head like this. Now, let's see how you do under pressure, Hawkeye. Shoot it off my head.
Go on and do it.
They traded songs and dialogue through email for more than 10 years, but eventually found themselves stuck. Their musical just didn't resemble anything fit for the stage. So, they brought their work in progress to the man who brought the music to the Coen Brothers movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And TV's Nashville, T-Bone Burnett.
The first thing I got was about 20 or 30 songs that were incredible songs. They had no destination in mind. They were just looking at what they had. There was this incredible wealth of material. It was this extraordinary story. And the thought of doing something like a radio play became very interesting.
Stephen King took the radio play idea and ran with it.
And my thought was, okay, we open this thing and we've got an old country DJ who's on the side and the spot comes up on him and he says, tragic news from Lake Belle Reve,
where it looks like a bad accident has occurred onto a double suicide.
And right away, you've got some of the background that you need. And we just kind of ran with that idea that we're looking at something that's going to be more of an auditory experience, or as much of an auditory experience as a visual one.
Let them crows pick your bones, let the wolves chew off your head. They'll not make you dig your own grave, they'll show that you was dead. Then I would be whistling all the way back home. Then I'd say a prayer, thank God that I won't have to see you no more.
I wonder if you would take me back to the premiere of the work, Atlanta, in April of last year, 2012. Mr. Mellencamp, what was your range of emotions on opening day, given that this was your baby from the start?
Well, you know, my whole goal, and I've told Steve this, is to just one day sit in the dark with Steve and watch this. That was it. I didn't care where it was at, what was going on. But to answer your question, I don't play well with the other kids. So my immediate reaction was I got pissed off and left. I think it was the only time I've ever raised my voice at Steve. Me, Steve, and T-Bone were sitting in there, and they were talking to the actors, and T-Bone sent me a text, John, you're scaring the horses.
You left the theater?
Yeah, I didn't leave the theater. I left Atlanta.
That was like 2 days before we opened, but he was back.
I came back, you know, but it was just I couldn't take it anymore because, you know, I'm used to saying, hey, put this guitar part on, and the guitar part goes on. Now, all of a sudden, I'm having to have conversations with people and saying, hey, this wardrobe is not working. Okay, we'll take care of it, and then nobody ever took care of it. Thank God T-Bone Burnett came down there to work with the band, because it was my band who I've worked with 1,000 times. But I was so put out with the sound engineer that I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I wanted to shoot myself, and the dialogue would start, and the volume would be down. Well, that just drove me nuts, because like the first
But it was a rehearsal. That's what it's for.
Hey,
he knows that now.
I know that now, but it still doesn't matter to me. And so it would just drive me lunatic. I mean,
I got to break in here. You know that saying about how some people do not suffer fools gladly? John doesn't suffer fools at all. And that's the absolute truth. I mean, I'm going to say flat out, John's the most talented person that I've ever worked with. This guy is so talented, he makes me look like a foothill compared to a mountain. You know, he just had it going on. And he wants things to be a certain way, and there's no slide zone with John. John wants to get it right. He wants it to be right. And when it's not, you know, I think in some ways he's like a mathematician or a chess prodigy who doesn't realize that other people don't get it the first time. The rehearsals for the show were ragged. There were problems there. And then opening night came, and we sat there in the dark at the back of the theater and watched the show and listened to the audience laugh the way that they're supposed to. And they were getting some of the lines and they were gasping. And at the end of the first act, they stood and applauded. I looked at John and said,
"We better leave
this
now."
I think what we said was, "We might as well die now."
Yeah,
because it was really great. It was
somebody better shoot us because it's not going to get any better than this.
You know that voice you hear in your head?
That's John Mellencamp, Stephen King, and T-Bone Burnett. They're the creative team behind the musical Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, just out on CD and DVD. They're taking that show on the road this fall. If you'd like to hear a sample, go to our website. It's nprmusic.org.
I can get you to do anything I want, 'cause I'm the sexy one with all that good stuff. It's me. Yes, baby. That's me.
For the week ending June 9th, 2013, that is the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the very best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Becky Sullivan, and Rima Krace. Our interns are Jan Stewart and Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior director. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.